In a system that depends on irresponsible government spending, especially for perpetual war, and fiat printing to cover that irresponsibility, alarm bells cannot be allowed to work. There must be no pure price signals. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are getting into a really cool little read today. A quick thank you to our sponsors, to Swan Bitcoin, who have been longtime big supporters of this show, and to CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. If you were looking for a place to buy your Bitcoin and then a place to keep it, you found them with Swan Bitcoin and the Cold Card. Genuinely, you solve like 90% of the difficulties and the hurdles of getting into Bitcoin securely and safely by just doing those two things, clicking those two links in that order in the show notes. So you should do that. And we've got a great little Twitter post, which a number of you tagged me in and said, you've got to do this one. And it's really short, but it's also really good, and there's a couple of really great nuggets of truth, so to speak, in this one. And I think if you want another one to go with it, I also talk about the Bitcoin is dead, long live IBIT in the Guy's Take, but one thematically that I think kind of enlightens the perspective around this is why the yuppie elite dismiss Bitcoin, or maybe that's not the title. I don't know. I'll find the link to that one. It's about Yuppie Elite, and it's a piece by Croesus. Really, really good about the perspective of kind of Normieland or TradFi mind. And this one is more targeted toward the SEC, towards policymakers, toward the Federal Reserve, towards the financial policy apparatus. And what is it about them that creates such incredible antagonism? Just vicious antagonism toward Bitcoin. What is it that Bitcoin exposes that they hate for people to see? And I don't want to give any more of it away. Let's go ahead and dive into the post, and then we will do a Guy's Take to follow. And it's titled, The Bitter Opposition to Bitcoin by Macroscope 17. I wonder how many really understand the bitter opposition by policymakers to Bitcoin, and especially an ETF. Gary Gensler doesn't really hate it because of investor protection. That's only a minor reason. Elizabeth Warren doesn't actually think its criminal use is significant. Obscure members of Congress who seem to pop up out of nowhere with Bitcoin of all things strangely on their minds, and who repeat these tiresome objections, often in laughable letters to the SEC, are in many cases quietly pushed to do so by others, including from the Fed, who understand the real threat. In a system that depends on irresponsible government spending, especially for perpetual war, and fiat printing to cover that irresponsibility, alarm bells cannot be allowed to work. There must be no pure price signals. And above all, an alarm bell must not also serve as a life raft that's easily accessible to everyone, especially the general public, in the form of an ETF. There must be no escape hatch. This is the unstated but important motivation for the long-standing resistance to Bitcoin, and especially an ETF. It's also why the three-judge panel of a federal appeals court that in 2023 essentially forced the SEC to approve the ETFs may ultimately turn out to be the most unsung but consequential people in the history of U.S. financial markets. After that court's ruling, you could almost hear public policymakers and some influential private sector figures, names that everyone knows and some very important ones who stay out of the news, smack their foreheads and say, those damn judges. Don't they realize what they've done? The system's defenders have always understood that life rafts and escape hatches can't be allowed. Here's Christine Lagarde talking about Bitcoin in 2021, ostensibly about the need for global cooperation on regulation. But the larger point was clear.
It's a matter that needs to be agreed at a global level, because, you know, if there is an escape, that escape will be used.
Here's a seminal essay by Alan Greenspan in 1966, when he was still in the private sector. Quote, "An almost hysterical antagonism toward the gold standard is one issue which unites statists of all persuasions. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves." I'd say the antagonism towards Bitcoin qualifies as hysterical, wouldn't you? And in terms of protection in a political system defined by profligacy and incompetent policy, especially monetary policy in recent years, a free trading asset that serves as protection and, via its price action, starkly highlights those two faults is resented and hated. This is why the Bitcoin ETFs in particular are so important, and why they were bitterly resisted for so long, and the SEC only approved them after being forced to do so by a court decision. Gold is usually slow-moving and can be suppressed, and even if it does rise to $2,500 or $3,000, DC and the Fed certainly won't like it, but it won't set off systemic alarms, and the public mostly won't notice. But if the ETFs help drive Bitcoin into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, the headlines will be screaming, and the public will start asking uncomfortable questions. With the Fed desperate to cut rates and a potential second inflation wave looming, it's easy to see why, from a policymaker perspective, the timing of ETF approval could not have been worse. And now Bitcoin and the ETFs, as permanent, fast-growing, and highly visible canaries in the financial system, will be perpetual burrs under the policy saddle. A telling postscript. Decades after Alan Greenspan wrote that essay about gold, Ron Paul asked him to autograph a copy of it as Fed chairman, and he asked if Greenspan wanted to add a disclaimer to it. Greenspan replied, "I stand by every word," and signed it. This episode is brought to you by CoinKite. Bob has been watching the price rise and feeling a little FOMO. So in a huge rush, he buys some Bitcoin, and having been following some solid Bitcoiners and listening to a few episodes of Bitcoin Audible, he actually withdraws his coins to his mobile wallet. He was supposed to get a cold card and write down a backup of his seed phrase, but he's going to do that later when he gets home. Of course, he forgets. A few weeks goes by and it pops into his head a few times. "That's right, I gotta take care of that," he thinks, but when he gets home and life and the family throw 100 new things at him, it's gone again until another few days goes by. Then he's hanging out on the boat with his friends one Saturday and he goes to pull his phone out of his pocket. It slips out of his hands, bounces on the deck, and when he grabs at it, his fingers hit it awkwardly and it careens into the water. It takes a full 5 seconds for it to hit him. All of that Bitcoin was on a mobile wallet without a backup. He never got his cold card. He never wrote down the seed phrase. All he had to do was get a solid hardware wallet, take the couple of minutes to set it up and make a backup, and then he could have still had it easily accessible on his phone with a simple tap. And he could have still lost his phone, and he'd have been sad about having to replace it, but not his Bitcoin. Because he did not pay the small cost of securing his coins, he paid the huge cost of his Bitcoin that he may never get again. Now when he sees the price go up, he's just sad and regretful. Do not be Bob. Get a cold card hardware wallet. Use code BitcoinAudible at checkout for a discount. The link is right there in the description of this episode. If you do, you won't regret it. But if you don't, you might. All right. So that was a great little article, post, whatever you want to call it. And what's funny is this is actually very much in line with something I've been talking about a lot in the past. I guess I haven't brought it up in a while, is that the pure price signal, that, and Macro specifically says this at one point, is that the most critical thing is that you cannot have a pure price signal in the market. And this has always been the problem with fiat, is that the only reason fiat works is because there is no escape valve. There is literally nothing with the bandwidth and the transactional capacity necessary. And I don't mean that in just like some, oh, one or two, like I'm going to make a transaction on the Bitcoin network or on chain. I mean it in the sense that you cannot have final transaction exit from the system at a degree of volume with gold. You just cannot do it because it is physical. Even initiating a multi-billion dollar movement of gold, if you're physically acquiring the gold, takes an enormous amount of time. And by the time you actually have obtained it, whatever the conditions or the changes in the market, like where the liquidity is, has already changed. So in the context of like businesses or banks settling between each other, the settlement time is so insanely long that as soon as the settlement is actually final, there's already more stuff to settle. It necessarily just has this enormous lag time. And that's if you do it physical, which is just absurd when you think about it on its face. Like, you're just going to put a whole bunch of gold on a ship and, you know, try to move it. Like, people don't do that. That's why we deal entirely in paper. And paper gold really isn't a whole lot different than paper fiat. And because it stays trapped, that's one of the big things that I try to harp on a lot, especially when people talk about like, oh, the ETFs are just going to do what gold did, or do to Bitcoin what they did to gold. And I still think it's a complete misunderstanding of where the problem of the ETF is, or excuse me, where the problem of gold is and what leads to the issues where gold basically is meaningless in this battle. The simple fact is that at scale, gold can't do anything. If there is some sort of potential crisis, if there is some sort of signal or shift from the Federal Reserve meeting notes, like let's say they do a ridiculous shift on interest rates, or they go on another printing spree, whatever it is, 24 hours after that occurs, nothing meaningful about the situation with gold or who owns it or where it is, like whether or not it's available in that market, has meaningfully changed at all. And in weeks after that, it's still going to be largely the same. It is only if there is literally a crisis, like an absolute crisis, that people are actually going to go through all of the difficulty of moving physical, of actually trying to move gold out of the hands, out of the counterparty risk of a financial market, of a particular jurisdiction or market. But when we're talking about Bitcoin, when Bitcoin is a $10 trillion market, you could have $2 trillion worth of outflows in a matter of hours. Think about it. 1,000 billionaires just decide that they're going to exit from the U.S. markets. And, you know, maybe 400 or 500 of those are actually institutions. They're institutions with thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of customers removing themselves from that market. And the customer doesn't even have to know. This is just the business protecting themselves from the U.S. financial markets. The business is still just, you just log into their server on the website or on the app or whatever it is. Customer doesn't know that the business has, you know, removed counterparty risk on their back end for some reason, or because they're trying to, you know, disconnect their pension or whatever it is from the U.S. contagion. This amount could move in a single block of transactions. This is why, as I have said in the past, if fiat continues to exist, what Bitcoin will do is it will make the Fed unable to continue their policies the way they want. It won't be just an elephant in the room. It will be a gun to their head that says, you can't do this or the whole thing goes up in smoke. And all it needs is legitimacy and liquidity for that to start taking place. Fiat money is socialism. It is simply socialism through a monetary tool, through a monetary implementation, rather than socialism through a political implementation. But it meaningfully results in the same thing. It just means that the government is in control of directing more of the capital than the market is. Fiat is a tool to do exactly that. Socialism only works if people can't say, "I would like to opt out." Because the only people who want to opt into socialism are the people who are going to get something, while everybody else is desperate to get out. And that's just during the initialization phase. After that, everybody just wants to get out because nobody has anything to eat. So as an analogy, I'm sure a lot of you have probably heard this one, but there's a really great story about a professor of economics who was, you know, basically during the first couple of days of their class, he's going off and talking about like the fundamental theory and about markets and all this stuff. And he ended up with an argument with a handful of people in the class. And they said socialism works and that you were wrong. And there's just argument back and forth. And he says, no, socialism doesn't work. And finally, they agreed, and the entire class agreed to this, that they were going to do an experiment, is that they were going to practice socialism in that classroom. And that everyone's grade in the classroom was actually just going to be the average. No one would excel and no one would, you know, be left behind. No one would fail. So on the first test, you know, pretty much generally everyone studied that was going to study. And there were a lot of great, quote unquote, grades in the class. And they all got averaged out to, like, I think it was a low B. Everybody who did bad on it and everybody who failed loved this. Absolutely loved it. The people who worked their asses off and actually made an A or got every question right were pissed. They got a low B while everybody else was just free riding. But the professor said there's nothing we can do about it. We can't let these other people get a low grade. This is important. But the next test comes around and all the people who had studied before were bitter and they just decided, I'm just not going to study either. Very next test, everyone failed. And as the story goes, I think the last test, like the average grade was like a 40 or something ridiculous. Like it plummeted really, really fast. And he failed the entire class because they agreed to it. And that's how it was going to happen. Understand, the only reason a system like that works is because nobody could opt out. After the first test, everybody who pushed that grade up, that average up, would have opted out. Every single one of them. Why? Because they don't want to work for nothing. Society sucks when everybody around you is just your burden, your mouth to feed, and another person who joins is just somebody else who's going to suck away the value that you've produced while they don't have to do anything. Bitcoin is the equivalent of letting those people take their test and then not give it to the professor. Walk out of the room, go to a different classroom and submit that test and still get the grade according to what they did. Bitcoin lets people leave the classroom. Fiat doesn't work if you can leave. Probably the best way to think about it is that what fiat and interest rate controls are is a system of price controls. It is literally capital controls on market prices. But it's in a market that is entirely established through a permissioned system. You have to have a banking license. You have to have permission. You have to have the quote-unquote right to participate in this. And you have to plug in directly to the Federal Reserve with a Federal Reserve account. And you can only do what the Federal Reserve Board and directors, like globally, this is the only way to interact with it, is you plug in to a permissioned, whitelisted, authoritarian system. Authoritative, in the sense that the money literally doesn't exist if the authority figures don't say that it does. Russia found this out very clearly. They had how many tens, dozens, hundreds of billions of dollars? I don't even remember what it was, but just with a stroke of a pen, just an announcement, they said, Russia doesn't have any of this anymore. This is not theirs. It's actually a money and debt system that exists entirely within a price control structure. And I don't even think it's necessary that they realize that this is a negative thing, that this is something that they are actually doing damage. But they know that if they don't have total control, the price controls are meaningless. So for even the people who feel that they're good-hearted and they're fixing things, Bitcoin is this grand, hysterical, evil thing because it doesn't let them fix all of the problems. In exactly the same way that if someone genuinely believed that socialism was going to save the world and everybody was going to live a happy life skipping through meadows and we were all going to be rich together, that they would know without question that if they let people opt out, the whole thing would die. Which is funny because right there lies proof that it won't work. If it requires you to build a prison in order to implement utopia, I'm sorry, it's not utopia. But that's the thing. They know. They know that an exit is the end of their charade. And the bigger it gets, the better it is as an exit. This is also why I think that if fiat continues to exist, it will only exist as a transaction proxy to Bitcoin. It will be backed by Bitcoin. And I literally think this is necessarily so because Bitcoin is a protocol. Because it's a permissionless protocol, there will never be a way for fiat to outcompete it in the pricing department. And I mean that as a unit of account. Like a lot of people say, it's going to just stay a store of value and it will never really be a medium of exchange and it certainly can't be a unit of account because it's too volatile. No, I completely disagree. There is no way that fiat or gold could ever be as liquid as Bitcoin because everything, all of the frictions of fiat and all of the limitations to the breadth that its market can even spread are entirely based on the fiat structure. It's based on the price control structure that the system has to have in order to keep its interest rates and debt issuance policy alive to begin with. So there's even without the price control system, it's still a permissioned system in the sense that the money is again an authoritative thing. It doesn't exist without the permission for it to exist. It is purely a credit instrument, which means it can only work with an enormous amount of restrictions. But then if you put a price control system on top of that credit system, you just keep adding frictions. You add things that you can't do with it. You add markets that it cannot work in. You add boundaries and borders that it cannot cross. You add times in which it cannot transact. Bitcoin, Bitcoin's layers, Bitcoin's side chains, Bitcoin's eCash, none of those things will have any of those borders or boundaries or restrictions. And it is entirely permissionless to build on and use. Purely from a technical sense, fiat can never be as liquid as Bitcoin can one day be. Which means that Bitcoin, not only being a sound money, that it will continuously go up in value, but it will also be the most stable pricing mechanism in the world, which means that fiat will increasingly get drastically more and more volatile as Bitcoin soaks up more and more of the store of value market. So as Bitcoin becomes a greater store of value, the triggering of price fluctuations will get, literally, fiat will become the volatile thing. The transition might be faster than we think. Like Parker Lewis isn't joking when he says it's a gradually then suddenly thing because it's a feedback mechanism. As the price fluctuations start to show up on the fiat side, as the Bitcoin price fluctuations begin to show as responses to, as pure price signals as to what is going on in the fiat and debt denominated world, very quickly that becomes a thermometer, so to speak, about what to do, which immediately results in a growing negative feedback loop for the fiat price stability and a growing positive feedback loop for the Bitcoin price stability. And, you know, increasingly, I think the story of the ETFs, I love that he points out that the appeals court, those three judges, may end up being one of the most consequential moments in the the forward-looking history of U.S. financial markets, because I think it will break. It essentially breaks the monopoly. It breaks the hold on how our financial system stores and allocates, controls where capital allocation is able to go. Because one of the things that's really interesting, like right now, is that, you know, using the New York Community Bank as an example is, and we will talk about this in actually to Wednesday's episode that drops with Clint from Liberty Lockdown. We talked about that quite a bit, about the continued, essentially the BTFP is, or BFTP? I can't remember the stupid acronym. Just another one of the stupid acronyms they have for printing money in a different way. But because it's expiring, we're going to start seeing a bunch of bank runs and a bunch of bank collapses start up again until the Fed basically steps in, until somebody steps in to plug the hole, because essentially it's been, quote unquote, temporarily plugged for a couple of years, and now it's just going to start unraveling. But the interesting thing is that in the world of, you know, APIs, is you can't actually have the entire fiat system go insolvent, even though the entire thing is insolvent. Like J.P. Morgan, who bought, I think it was First Signature Bank, or maybe they bought Silicon Valley Bank. I don't know. A couple of the major banks basically swallowed up the smaller banks that were that collapsed in the last crisis that occurred a couple of years ago. But what I thought was so funny about that is that the bigger banks, J.P. Morgan in particular, was actually more leveraged than the bank that they purchased. And they used a government loan, a government-secured loan, to buy the less leveraged collapsing bank. So why doesn't J.P. Morgan, why don't the big banks have the same problem? It is purely because there's not a big enough entity for the money to flow out of. Like if you moved 10%, 15% of the deposits out of JP Morgan, the bank would go under. But there is no other bank that can handle an influx of 10% of the balance of JP Morgan. Or at least, I guess the better way to say it, it's not that like that money couldn't move. It's that the only place to go when the entire system is leveraged is centralization, is to consolidate to a bigger and bigger pool of the leverage. This is specifically why all that ends up happening is that we continue to centralize, we continue to consolidate until the problem is as big as it possibly can be, and essentially the last center can't hold. Then the debt market breaks and the currency breaks. The funny thing about the ETFs becoming, you know, multi-trillion dollar part of the market is that it represents a direct sale of the dollar. And because the dollar is the most liquid market, it's not seen as that. But increasingly, the price will start to show that. Very slow at first, but starting more and more, like I said, a negative feedback loop for fiat. As soon as it starts to show up, it's probably just going to accelerate in a really big way. And I think in this cycle, what we'll see, you know, a lot of people talk about like, the ETFs are going to take over and then we're going to be trapped again, blah, blah, blah. The reason why I don't think that's going to happen is, well, it's a number of different reasons. And I'll be sure to link to the Bitcoin is Dead, Long Live IBIT read, because I think I really just kind of go over it pretty well in that episode. If you haven't listened to it, I highly encourage it. And I'd like to hear what you think about my assessment, but I just do not think that that's realistic. I think it's a fundamental understanding of where the problems of gold are and why the gold ETF didn't fix it. And that the problem with Bitcoin is not something that shows up. It doesn't recreate gold situation just because it has an ETF. But I do think there's a very high likelihood that the ETFs become an extraordinarily large, maybe even a majority of the Bitcoin market on a temporary timeline. So it'll be a little bit more like a kind of like Ghash.io back in the day. For those of you who don't know, back in 2013, we had a there was a big especially during the switch from GPUs to FPGAs, which I almost bought an FPGA, but the whole cycle just went so fast. And if you were even ordering you know, mining hardware for any of that stuff. It was in like no time at all that the next thing was there. And if you just had a company that was promising they were going to have an FPGA or an ASIC or something, and they just delivered 3 months late, the whole, you could literally just be demolished. Like it was accelerating so fast that just the speed at which your order was fulfilled could be the difference between you making an extraordinary amount of Bitcoin off of your miner and you making almost nothing off of your miner. It was crazy. But because of that, there was also a massive amount of fluctuation and changes and growths and collapses in the mining pool market. Essentially, everything was really volatile. And while a whole bunch of people talk about like now, it's like, oh, mining is centralized, it was way worse back then, especially for a couple of different periods. And there was one specific period, I think it was in 2013, probably. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it coincided with the whole cycle around Mt. Gox and stuff. But Ghash.io, which was a really, really popular mining pool at the time, just kept growing and kept growing, and a whole bunch of people joined it because it had obviously the most reliable payouts, and everybody just wanted to join the pool. And then it ended up peaking. It actually crossed, and it was like nobody even thought about it or recognized that this was a big problem until it was like 49% of the entire network hash rate. And then it went to 51-52%, I think. But it broke the 51% attack threshold. And a single mining pool could have completely, could have just attacked and done, you know, significant disruption to the network. It wouldn't have really killed anything. Wouldn't have been a problem in any grand sense. It just would have been kind of an epic moment in Bitcoin's history if it had actually happened. We actually have a lot of cases now, even though we don't have one specifically on Bitcoin, of what happens with a 51% attack and how long you could expect them to even go on in certain cases, and depending on the adversary, because there's a lot of secondary proof of work coins that got hit with 51% attacks. But regardless, it was everybody was flipping out, just chaos. It was, the Reddit page was just nothing but Ghash. Oh my god, Bitcoin, everything's gonna die now. And you know, with respect, it was a crazy thing. I was like, what in the hell? This is nuts. But very, very quickly, the whole thing plummeted. People were logging out and moving into, you know, other mining pools, and the distribution happened really quick. Then Ghash made an announcement because everybody was like, oh, they're going to attack. And Ghash was like, we have no idea. We have no reason to attack. Why would we attack? People were just joining. Like, we're not here to hurt Bitcoin. And so they, like, specifically capped it. Like, they manually capped it at 49%. And then all the hash rate just started flowing out and going to all other places. And then I think it was like even within a year or something, Ghash was basically dead. Or maybe they just kind of lingered on for a while after that. I don't know. But it became irrelevant very, very quickly. But the reason I bring that up is because I can very much see something like this happening with the ETFs. Because the ETFs, as Macro actually says here, is that they are the canary in the financial system. But here's the thing. What is the result of the canary dying, right? What's the result of basically the signal going off in full force and having people within the US, having retail investors be able to pile into these ETFs insanely quickly and the price of it skyrockets? Well, what happens after that? Immediately, the entire rest of the world is trying to leave dollars. And they're not going to buy US ETFs. What's going to happen is a global outflow of capital from the dollar markets and from the really probably just fiat debt markets in general will cascade. Because if the dollar starts to crack, well, everything smaller than the dollar, which practically all of it has worse debt to GDP ratios, I think everything else just starts to domino. I think there's just going to be contagion across the board. It's going to be nuts. And the exit on a global scale start to readjust the amount of Bitcoin capital in a really, really big way. And the bigger the contagion gets in the US, the worse the situation gets in the US, the more I think people will start to fear, especially foreign entities, but even retail, the more it will be clear that they should be afraid that the ETFs won't actually mean anything in regards to Bitcoin. And then the ETF price and the Bitcoin price will diverge. basically the risk of the ETF will start to price in the counterparty risk, and people will be dumping it. They'll be directly trading ETF Bitcoin for actual Bitcoin for people who were like, oh, you're just worried the government's not going to confiscate it. The government's not going to steal all of this. And the price will have a huge premium to get real Bitcoin versus the ETF coins. Because what happens when you have sound money? You have sound money that you can actually hold in a sovereign sense and actually has no counterparty risk. But what it does is it's going to price actual counterparty risk incredibly well, something that fiat can't do because it is a counterparty risk. And though this won't be a fungibility problem for Bitcoin, this will be a fungibility problem for credit, which the ETF is. Then at that point, I think everything is just up in the air. What happens? You know, does the government try to confiscate it and then, you know, back the dollar with it? Or do keys accidentally get burned by somebody or get stolen? I don't know. Fireworks will fly when that day comes. I still wonder if, especially with these large institutions, I highly suspect there will be a it just seems like, you know, if you want to look back at history and you're thinking about like a cryptographic system and you're thinking about a sound money and you're thinking about like the costs, like you look at like Mt. Gox and stuff, like what is the cost of learning the lessons for this thing to actually work? I think when we move into the nation state zone and we move into that environment and suddenly we have businesses and financial institutions that are challenging the state and their ability to hold and protect their capital is external to the state, and the state comes in with kind of like a nuke everything sort of policy to basically like shut it down, I think there will be a Wyatt's torch situation. That it's very possible that that could occur. And for those of you who haven't read Atlas Shrugged, Wyatt's torch is the government tried to confiscate and force him to make steel or whatever it was. I can't even remember exactly, but make it for all of these other companies and basically just socializing it and saying that you're still in charge, but you have to do everything that we say and you can't charge any fair prices. Like, we're just going to obliterate your market and your control over any of it. And Wyatt disappears and he, oh no, it was oil. Of course it was oil because it's Wyatt's torch. Is he set his entire business on fire and the oil wells. And because of that, it just kept burning. That's why it was a Wyatt's torch and it just continued to burn. So in that sense, it's actually a pretty good analogy, because what could very possibly be the case, what could be very, very interesting, is to see an actual challenge. Like, I don't know, let's say MicroStrategy and Sailor. The government says, you cannot hold this, you have to give us your coins. I feel like with, and not necessarily Sailor, but with so many new entrants and institutions that are just dipping they're making their first entry into this space and doing their first initial setups and designs for security and how to keep their coins safe, and probably the overwhelming majority are not even considering the U.S. as a potential attacker in this situation, so they are not designing it properly. There's a very strong likelihood, in my opinion, that when the conflict reaches its peak, it's very likely that some sort of critical key gets lost, or maybe even out of defiance in a Wyatt's torch sort of way, an enormous amount of coins get burned instead of making their way to whatever government entity it is that is trying to steal it. But I mean, obviously, that's just like total speculation. It just seems like I could look back 10 years from now and go, yeah, it made sense that that totally happened. That, you know, one of the ETFs just got obliterated and those coins are stuck there forever and there's nothing anybody can do about it. It's like a great scar from the Bitcoin wars left on the time chain. But this was a really great thread or Twitter post. And you know, there's one other thing I actually want to say. And by the way, I do not know Macroscope here, Macroscope 17. But I'll have the link and Twitter link to the post as well as just their Twitter page so that you can follow them. But one of the other things that he points out was that I thought was really cool was the Alan Greenspan. That his essay in 1966 talking about how statists universally have a quote-unquote hysterical antagonism toward the gold standard and that it's necessary, is that if there is a strong enough, liquid enough, accepted enough exit, that the entire system, the financial policy that is at odds with what gold actually protects, that you know, works through inflation, through the welfare state, that it's literally not possible to maintain it. And the key that I think is important is the postscript that he added, that Ron Paul asked him if he wanted to add a disclaimer while he was the Fed chairman. And he said, "I stand by every word." Now, I wanted to point that out simply because I think it's interesting that it's telling. Because I think there's an element of even those in power, those in these positions, even if they wanted to do something drastically different or they wanted to correct it, they really don't have a choice. They don't really have an option. Now, granted, Alan Greenspan was, you know, the most hawkish of a Fed chairs since, I don't know, probably ever. I think, you know, the interest rates, he jacked them up to like 9 or 10% at one point. And he literally salvaged the disaster of, you know, coming out of the 70s and in the 80s. But it's not like Greenspan could have actually backed it with gold again. It's not possible because of the structure of the fractional reserve system and because of how the entire political environment even works. I think there's very much a situation of the system limits what is even possible. And because of how fiat works, because of how the fractional reserve system is designed, we could not even go back to a gold standard unless we obliterated the system as we know it today. And I say obliterate because genuinely, you would have to, like all the pensions, everything that we think of as worthy of its price or worth its relevant value because of leverage, which is all bank deposits, which is all of our equity, all of our retirement accounts, everything. It would have to be obliterated in order to even begin to attempt to do that again. But the thing is if there is an exit, it'll do that all by itself because it's broken. It is fundamentally broken. But because value and money in particular is an intersubjective thing, it can only be realized in comparison to something else. So I think Macroscope hit the nail on the head. There is vicious, hysterical antagonism toward Bitcoin, specifically because Bitcoin is a giant exit door that is growing, and they know that nothing they do works if there is an exit. But they aren't going to be able to plug that hole. Huge thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite for sponsoring this show, to the Audionauts, and to you all. I will catch you on the next episode, and until then, take it easy, guys. The first duty of a man is to think for himself. Jose Marti.